You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a doctor about how COVID-19 has affected the Menominee tribe. Now, there's been a lot of anger in our politics this year and some speculation about political violence during a contentious election. Researchers from the Universities of Louisville, Maryland, and elsewhere have shown a small but growing minority of Americans who identify as Republicans or Democrats think there could be at least a little justification for violence in the wake of an election loss. It's an increase from just a few years earlier. While there are warning signs out there, our next guest says there's a lot that the media, politicians, and the rest of us can do to help calm things down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the prospect of any kind of violence tied to the election? What do you think could be toned down to dial down the anger on the extremes and avoid that? Do you think the media focuses too much on the extremes? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda Ripley is a journalist and contributing writer at The Atlantic. Her books include The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes, and Why. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
You did an interesting project recently. You got together with journalists from countries where there has been election-related violence and talked to them about lessons they've learned about the coverage. What kind of things did you hear from them?
Right. So it feels very unprecedented what's happening here in the United States. But in fact, you know, there are lots of countries that have had disputed elections, very polarized climates, and political violence. So it was really helpful to talk to them. They all recognized all the signs. This felt very familiar to them, but they also felt like there's a lot that can be done, particularly from the news media's side, because that's, you know, that's how people get their information. When there's a crisis, people turn to the news media more than ever. And there are mistakes that journalists make without realizing it that can actually really amp up the odds of political violence. So that was very helpful to hear. And, you know, just to take a quick example, one of the things that they all said, this is from Bangladesh to Venezuela to Sierra Leone, is that they tend to put aside competition with other media outlets surrounding an election. So they actually work together, sort of like a pool. And they do this so that they can help each other confirm facts, squelch rumors, and decide when to release results as one voice. And they found that to be extremely helpful in the kind of confusion of an election.
One thing that might sound kind of small, but can have a big impact, you gave a list of recommendations rejecting violent metaphors and headlines. So our campaign battles and things like that. Why does that make a difference?
Yeah, the words that people use actually matter more than I think I would have expected. So when people use violent imagery, words like war and even fight and kill and those kinds of things, even if they're speaking metaphorically, that does seem to have an impact, subconsciously or not, on people's willingness to condone or engage in violence. And conversely, this is the cool thing, when people call for peace and condemn all forms of violence, that too has a calming effect. It has an effect of making people feel like if they were to commit an act of violence, they would not be supported by their community. And that's a very big deal. So, you know, in other countries before an election like this, there would be a lot of people of great influence, pop culture stars, musicians, politicians coming out and proactively condemning all acts of violence. Some of that has happened, but not really specifically for the election. And I don't think media outlets have really amplified that as much as they might in post-conflict countries where they're more familiar with the power of those words.
You also talk a lot about setting context when there are incidents. And I think you looked at the examples of the protests over the last year. Do you zoom in on the bonfire and the angry confrontations? Do you include the context of the peaceful ones that happen at the same time? Do you show a close-up of the armed protesters or a wider view of them showing that their numbers are fairly small? How do we focus on those events that do happen but aren't necessarily the whole story?
This is probably the single most important thing we could do. You have to give people the denominator. So you have to report on small fringe extremist groups and acts of violence, right? Like that's That is news. And in the very next breath, you have to put it in perspective. You have to say, you know, if there's violence at one polling place, that there are no reports of violence at 99% of polling places across the state, so that people get a sense of the full picture. This is something in, say, Liberia, what they do is they intentionally go for around the horn. They go around the circuit and they show, they get reporting on the ground from reporters in, you know, 20 different or maybe hundreds of different locations so that they can give viewers a sense of the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? Not just the ugly.
And did I see, I think it was Bangladesh, I don't have it right in front of me, where there had been an actual election day attack on a polling site. And rumors going around that this was happening everywhere in the country when it wasn't. Correct me if I'm wrong about the country, but and then tell me how journalists tackled that.
Right. No, it was Burundi, but you're right. What often happens is it just takes a very small number of people who are extremists to take illegal action and commit an act of violence. And sometimes they do it intentionally to create chaos and suppress voter turnout. So no one wants to get hurt, right? They don't want to, you know, get in the middle of that. So then they stay home. So this is really important to know about, like to understand that sort of calculus. So in Burundi, these gunmen began firing on voters in one town during an election. They wanted to create chaos and stop people from coming out. Their rumors started swirling immediately that many polling stations had been attacked and that the election was being canceled. But this network of journalists fanned out across the country, along with other sort of local community leaders, worked together to quickly track that down, check with sources on the ground. And they said, no. That was just one isolated instance of violence, and the election had not been canceled. So the faster you're able to just chase down those rumors, the more violence you can prevent. That's particularly critical, obviously, in a time of social media.
Talking to Amanda Ripley, a journalist, looking at ways to dial down fears of political violence, the risk of political violence. She has lessons for the American media from countries around the world where media outlets have had to deal with actual election day violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Cindy joins us now in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I have to say the media does take a lot of responsibility for this, but so do our politicians, because all you hear them talk about is, oh, I'll fight for you, and we need to have war machines and all this kind of stuff. And I wish as people we would realize that we're all Americans. We need to start getting along. We need to stop this divisiveness, and we need to realize that we're all in this together. And I think it's just a matter.
Thanks a lot for the call, Cindy. And Amanda, Cindy's pointing right toward, I think, a common theme I've heard from you, not just in this report, but in the past as well.
I think Cindy speaks for almost all of us. I think that people like Cindy don't get heard because they're not, you know, screaming at each other on TV or on Twitter, right? The media has a bias for extremists, right? For lots of reasons. Some are on purpose, some are not. Many are not. But she is right, and we know from lots of good research by More in Common, this has done probably some of the best research on this, that there's something they call the exhausted majority. The vast majority of Americans are sick and tired of the divisiveness, of the yelling, of the paralysis, of the way that the conflict has become so self-destructive. So I think there's a huge opportunity here for people who are ready to do something different.
Now, it needs some changes in journalism if people agree with that argument. And this is something we do on this show. Here's side A, here's side B. I think our callers probably self-select to people who feel strongly on either pole, unlike Cindy. How do we kind of, I guess, cultivate that thing of looking at common shared values instead of the extremes arguing with each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to realize that our audience is can handle more complexity than we think. And that's especially true at a time of high conflict where everything's being sort of oversimplified, right? There's a sort of false simplicity going on. So people are kind of yearning for more complexity. And they are interested in the fact that most stories have like seven sides. Most people have multiple tensions within them about their own party affiliation. Nobody's 100% on board with everything that the political party they support is doing. And those kind of complexities actually make conflict more interesting and can revive a sense of humility and curiosity when we need it most. So some of it's sort of the stories we do. Some of it's, again, including that denominator, that larger picture. Always, always, always. Like, I think it's just particularly key for editors to do this. But, you know, if you're going to write about, say, long lines at polling places, we have a lot of good data about what that looks like over history and from state to state. And it's really important to contextualize it. So, for example, we know that in 2018, African American and Hispanic voters waited longer on average than white voters. But the average for African Americans was 11.5 minutes to vote, and Hispanic 11.7 minutes, and white voters 8.8 minutes. So the vast majority of Americans did not wait longer than 30 minutes. They actually waited much less than that. There are exceptions. Voters in Georgia waited 18 minutes, which is 23 times longer than voters in Vermont, which was 46 seconds. So you can see it's really important for people to get a sense. What does this look like? What does the picture here look like and across town and across the state and across the country? And I think people can handle that kind of breadth and perspective, and not only can handle it, but are actually really craving it.
We're talking to journalist and author Amanda Ripley about fears of political violence near Election Day and what the media, politicians, and everyone else can do to calm things down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that has you worried as we come closer to Election Day? Voting going on already, but there's still that one big day coming up. What kind of election coverage do you want to see and hear in the media? Do you worry that you hear too much in the media, whatever your media diet is, from the extremes on either side? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with journalist and Atlantic contributor Amanda Ripley about how to prevent political violence in a polarizing election year, how to talk about these issues as well, especially here in the media. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your worries and hopes for how we get along in this election season. Again, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda, election day, election season rumors are nothing new, but as you mentioned, social media can amplify them, make them spread faster. How do you see media outlets in particular tackling rumors and quashing them if they turn out to be false?
Yeah, the way this usually works here and all over the world is that rumors start flying of one group disrespecting or harming another, right? It could be burning down a mosque in one country. It could be attacking a polling station or a voter in another, or sort of intimidating voters. Then it doesn't matter if the rumor's true, because in a polarized climate, it will be believed by a good number of people. So then you very quickly have to work together, ideally with relationships you already have on the ground, to find out what's really going on. And for media outlets, especially around an election, that means you never want to be first. This is counter to everything we normally do, but you do not want to break news like this around an election. You will not sleep at night afterwards. You want to be the one to confirm whether it's true or false, to call people on the ground, to reach out to other media outlets so you can expand your ability and your capacity to be in many places at once. Again, not something we normally do in most cases, but you have to be the one to try to figure out what is really going on. And that's where these pre-existing relationships are really important. You know, if you know the local religious leaders or mayor or police chief or sheriff, like activists, all these people, now is a good time to kind of reconnect with those people or meet them for the first time. It's a very bad time to do that in the midst of a crisis.
What strikes me, though, sometimes, Amanda, take a mass shooting situation. Responsible media outlets are saying what they know and what they don't know, and they aren't able to update things quickly, and that's good and responsible. But into the vacuum, with all the people clicking refresh and wanting new details, that's where rumor mongers jump in and start spreading completely invented rumors. Is there a way? I don't know. What do you even do about that?
That is a really hard problem. Like, we haven't figured out how to manage that, right, as a society with the tools that we have sort of outpaced our ability to manage them. One thing I would do is keep continually educating and reminding your audience that this will happen. So don't wait for rumors to happen. Say, you know, we know that there will be false rumors online around this election, and we're going to try to track them down, and we're going to ask for your help, and we're going to ask for your patience, and we're going to ask for you not to spread them. You know, I mean, these, it's really just put it all out there, right? Just the way you tell your fellow reporters not to retweet things that they haven't confirmed. Let's talk to the audience with that same level of respect. Part of the way we rebuild trust in the news media in this country, which I think we'd all agree we desperately need to do, is by treating the public as allies, right? Like really deputizing the public. Again, vast majority of people want this to be a peaceful and fair election, like, you know, 99.9% of people. And so these are our allies. They are not people that we have to, that are sort of waiting to be informed anymore. They're going to go get information. And so let's use that to our advantage and tell people to prepare for false rumors and not assume that they are true.
Go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Joanne is with us in Elroy. Joanne, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Joanne?
Well, I work in a hardware store that sells guns and ammunition. We have a lot of Trump supporters that work in the store and also shop at the store. Thank God I'm wearing a mask so they can't see me biting my tongue all day long. But I'm hearing customers that are saying, if Trump is not reelected, there's going to be a revolution. There's going to be a civil war. They're buying guns. They're buying ammo. We cannot keep it stocked. And it scares the hell out of me.
Joanne, thanks a lot for the call. Amanda, are there legitimate worries here?
Yeah, that's terrifying, right? I mean, I think there are legitimate worries, and I don't think Joanne's alone in being worried, but it must be very hard to sort of see that happening. I think 3 out of 4 Americans recently said in a poll that they are worried about widespread violence after the election. One thing that's really important to know is that the preconditions to people becoming violent during a tense election season is a couple of different things. If they feel that the processes are illegitimate, or if they feel helpless, all right? So those are the two key things and two opportunities to kind of intervene in advance. We have a ton of processes in place in the United States. We've been running elections for almost 250 years, including during wartime. So the problem is they're kind of arcane and complicated, and they vary from place to place. So it's really important that people know what those rules are in advance about, you know, when polling places will close, how mail-in ballots are going to work. And I think in a lot of places, news outlets are trying to do a good job of sort of educating themselves and the public on those rules. But there are other things that are really important to know. Like, for example, all 50 states have some provision in their law that prohibits private military, paramilitary, militia activity. That's the case in Wisconsin. It's the case all around the country. Untrained, unaccountable civilians who are armed cannot take official functions, cannot act like a police officer or a soldier. And it's important that law enforcement know this, right? Unfortunately, not everyone knows this, but there's a great resource that that is available through Georgetown University. They've put together 50 fact sheets, one for each state. And this is the kind of thing that it's really important that readers know it and listeners know it and reporters know it in advance, because again, we don't want people to feel helpless. I mean, there are laws on the books in this country that make taking the law into your own hands illegal, particularly in this kind of climate. It is important, though, that they be understood and enforced.
Joanne, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Amanda Ripley about how to help prevent violence on Election Day and how to talk about it in the media as well. Amanda, as we move closer to Election Day, what kind of things are you watching for to see if your effort is successful here, if we're turning the tide on the way we talk about the election?
Well, I think that a lot of this is sort of, it's just like lack of knowledge. And so some of it is sort of sharing knowledge and also suggesting better ideas. Like I saw today, there was a really great thread on Twitter about how, you know, a lot of news outlets are running these stories like, you know, militia activity may become violent around polling sites. And then they have pictures that are very frightening of heavily armed people. And those kind of speculative stories are not that helpful. Obviously, it's a news event if that happens. But again, kind of shifting the focus to what are the laws in our state? Like, what can we do in advance? Like, what do we know about prohibiting private individuals from taking official law enforcement functions? This is again, like, just to be super clear, this may feel scary and uncertain, but this pattern is well established all over the world. I don't know if this is reassuring or not, but this is what happens in places that become hyper-polarized, is people begin to demonize one another. Then they feel frightened of one another. Then political leaders can exploit that, as has happened here, and make it worse, right? And sort of gin up the fear, right? And then what happens is there's some act of violence, and we've already seen many acts of violence in this country leading up to this election. We've had something like 70 drivers drive into peaceful protesters. So there's some act of violence, and then there's an act of retribution from the other side, right? And then one thing leads to another, the violence gets worse, and then voters will tend to choose a strongman ruler kind of leader, not always, but because they're frightened, that's the decision they make. And when that happens, you start losing various freedoms, including the freedom of the press. So that pattern is really well established. This kind of behavior that we're seeing, militia activity, armed private paramilitaries, extreme rhetoric, that kind of activity is very common in other countries. And it looks just like this. So that's on the one hand, very unnerving, right? On the other hand, we know a ton about it. Very few countries have invested as much in researching and trying to prevent political conflict around the world than the United States. So people who do that work have turned their focus to the United States and are doing a lot of good work to try to prevent and mitigate against that risk.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me.
Amanda Ripley is an author, journalist, and contributor to The Atlantic. She talked with us about fears of political violence tied to the election and what we can do to prevent it. Coming up, we talk with a doctor about the spread of COVID-19 on the Menominee Reservation. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we've got a lot of household name Apple varieties like the Cortland, Honeycrisp, Macintosh, but there are many others we might not be so familiar with. We'll talk to a Wisconsin orchard owner about taking a bite out of the lesser-known varieties. Now, the Menominee tribe has extended emergency orders and temporary closures because of an increase in COVID-19 cases. The tribe, like Wisconsin as a whole, has seen a sharp rise in cases since mid-September after staying in single digits throughout much of the spring and the first half of the summer. Menominee County, which shares nearly the same borders as the reservation, now has more than 170 positive cases. Myron Piawasset, the brother of a Menominee tribal legislator, spoke in a public service video about how he and his wife and kids were all infected by COVID-19.
It struck our nervous system, our muscles, our joints. It affected our lungs. We couldn't breathe.
Dr. Amy Slagle is a family physician at Menominee Tribal Clinic. Dr. Slagle, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us some about how you've seen COVID-19 affect the Menominee community?
Well, we kept it at bay and at really low levels up until mid-September, and it was well in check. And suddenly, in a twinkle, it was not. We had our 19th case on September 2nd. On the 15th, we had our 115th, and today, as you mentioned, we're up over 170 cases. So that's just in over a month. So we've had essentially exponential growth without any super spreader events or any major outbreaks, no cases traced to our casino or any public gatherings or events. It's just been a very slow but steady spread that's happened in 1,000 different places. So it's become very serious very quickly.
What kind of emergency orders are now in effect after this big jump in cases?
Well, we used an emergency order put in place by our incident command group to basically roll back our reopening plan for the tribe. So all of the tribal government programs and associated entities and buildings are all rolled back to essential workers only. Everyone who can work from home is doing so. The schools are doing only remote learning, 100%. That includes our private tribal school and also our public school district. Bars and restaurants are curbside only. The casino has been closed again now for over 3 weeks. Our mill, which is a major source of revenue and jobs for the tribe, has been in place for over 150 years, is open, but working with a very skeleton crew. So it's really a pretty intense shutdown going on. We had hoped it would only last a few weeks, but now we are looking at least through October 19th, if not longer, if we don't start seeing a decrease in cases.
And you're in a part of the state that's seeing big increases, too. Is this is there anything unique about how this is hitting the Menominee community, or is this just part of a state that's it's hitting all at once now?
Well, I think what's happened here mirrors what's happened in our area, and we are officially included in the Fox Valley HERC. But it's happening with a bit of a rigorous ferocity that I would relate to some of the things that are strengths and prideful parts of the Menominee culture, and that's that families like to live together. So there are multi-generations living in one home, and so someone picks up COVID at their workplace because masks weren't enforced, and they bring it home to a parent and to a grandparent and to a great aunt. Then you have people who are elders and vulnerable who have many comorbid diseases, and those people are at great risk for worse outcomes with COVID. And we are basically at the brink of that today. We had a report just this afternoon of a tribal member passing away from COVID. So it's here. And because of the multi-generational family living situation, once it takes hold, it's going to be devastating. These kind of cultural issues are much like what the Navajo experienced in terms of their housing. We've got better infrastructure in many ways, but the families living together in overcrowded or multi-generational homes is our biggest concern for spread from the young people to our vulnerable elders.
And you mentioned the HERC, I think that's the Healthcare Emergency Readiness Coalition. Are you in providing healthcare in the Menominee community in regular contact with other healthcare providers in the region to coordinate your efforts?
Sure. We have a very good clinic facility here. We have seven doctors on staff here and several nurse practitioners. All of our physicians are active staff at Theta Care Shawnee Hospital, which is 8 miles south of Menominee County. So that's where we primarily hospitalize. We have patients who go to both Green Bay and Fox Valley for tertiary care services. So we're well plugged into those hospital systems. We have an excellent ambulance service, but we're suffering from the same problem as everyone else, is there's no hospital capacity. Last night at our hospital, there were patients being put in OB rooms because there were no beds left on the regular medical surgical floor.
What message would you have for people, both in the community you're serving and around the state, for how they approach and think about COVID and the precautions they take?
If you don't take it seriously, take it seriously now. There are people dying, and there's a lot of counterfactual information going on about that. But if you know a physician or a nurse or a healthcare provider listen to what they are experiencing and seeing, because it's very real. And the things that we have are very simple. They're public health tools, and they're wearing a mask, and they're staying out of other people's homes and keeping that 6 feet of distance. The things which could help are so simple, but they've been weaponized. And now we're going to see deaths. We're going to lose people because it has not been taken seriously.
Dr. Slagle, best to you and the patients you're working with. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Amy Slagle is a family physician at the Menominee Tribal Clinic. She talked to us about how the virus has spread within the Menominee Reservation. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about language.
The United States is a nation of immigrants, and the pressure to assimilate can be great. Some people are compelled to speak English and leave other languages behind. Here's contributor Eric Dregney with a look back at his own family's relationship with language.
Those traitorous Scandinavian languages. Don't be suspected. My grandparents spoke a mix of Norwegian and Swedish, or Svorsk, as it was known. They used it mostly when they wanted an unintelligible language to keep secrets from the grandkids. How I wish they'd passed on this language to me! Being second-generation Scandinavians, they wanted to keep their distance from their immigrant parents, and their thick accents, and their old-world ways. I used to believe this. I thought that the old language fell into disuse, and immigrants wanted to learn English. This perpetuated half-truth doesn't tell the tale of government agents spying on Scandinavian and German meetings looking for socialists or anti-war activists. Settlers spoke English as a matter of self-preservation, and any dissension was deemed unpatriotic. My grandfather told me he could only speak Norwegian when he entered kindergarten, and then would get in trouble since he didn't know English. How could he? I begged my grandfather to teach me Norwegian, but he warned me, "We're in America. We speak English. It's better that way." Clearly, he was scared of something I didn't understand. Then I discovered that some state governments set up a Commission of Public Safety during World War I. Its purpose, to root out those deemed untrustworthy. It was mostly Germans, and Scandinavians by default, those with mixed loyalty who could be considered traitors. These commissions employed virtually dictatorial powers to distribute pro-war propaganda and to restrict activities it considered hostile. These government agents infiltrated meetings and rallies to make lists of radicals and slackers, as well as just plain foreigners who lacked enthusiasm to go to war. Because it was wartime, those who questioned could be locked up indefinitely. These commissions posted notices that read, "Don't be suspected. Use American language. America is our home." This was why my grandfather was afraid. But apparently, the story was not unique. A young Swedish boy in Ashland, Wisconsin, during World War I said, "We never speak Swedish on the street. Olaf was roughed up by some of the Yankee boys in a restaurant last week." Because Scandinavian languages are somewhat similar to German, anyone caught speaking them was viewed as having foreign sympathies and possibly a spy for Kaiser Wilhelm. Of course, it didn't help that the pro-Hitler German-American Bund set up Camp Hindenburg in Grafton, Wisconsin in the 1930s to help young German kids become good Nazis. Up until the World Wars, immigrants often had little incentive to learn English, since most daily business transactions happened in their native language. Jim Jensen, a TV newscaster from Kenosha, said, "If you went to the Danish Brotherhood, you spoke Danish. At church, the services, the sermon, my confirmation ceremony, all in Danish." Churches and social organizations tried to retain their language, although they were on the lookout for infiltrators. Many would begin conversations in English and then slip into their native tongue once they felt safe. Many churches switched services to English to show loyalty to the U.S., but mostly to avoid suspicion. One Lutheran parishioner joked, "I have nothing against the English language. I use it myself every day. But if we don't teach our children Norwegian, what will they do when they get to heaven?"
Eric Dregney teaches English at Concordia University in St. Paul. He's the author of several books, including Vikings in the Attic, In Search of Nordic America. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, how many Wisconsin apple varieties can you name? We talked to a local orchard owner about some varieties beyond the basics that you can try this fall. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6, an unexpected discovery on Venus has opened up a new search for signs of potential alien life on nearby planets. What is out there and can we call it life? Plus a conversation with the Earthside star of Star Trek Discovery. That's today at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, one big fall tradition here in Wisconsin is apple season, with many people choosing to go apple picking, buying a bag at a local orchard, maybe doing some baking. But a lot of times we stick with the same kinds of apples, Macintosh, Cortland, Honeycrisp, and so on. But there are a lot of other varieties that get less recognition. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite kind of apple? Well-known or not, what do you want to know about running an orchard and growing apples here in the state? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Beth left us a comment there. She said a friend of hers in Minneapolis used to bring her apples from a tree at his cabin that she thinks were Spencer apples, pure white inside, very firm. She says they took a long time to cook down into applesauce, but so delish. Kurt Leiterman is the owner of Applelicious Orchard in Green Bay. Kurt, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Kurt, I understand you've got a relatively new orchard, but you've got some apple roots, some memories that go way back. Can you talk about what drove you to want to start an orchard?
Well, I was looking to kind of preserve the land the way I feel God intended it, to live off of eating it, eating what we can produce. And I'm growing a healthy product for people to enjoy.
Now, if you got a coffee fan or a serious buff, they'll talk about all sorts of nuances and varieties. Same with beer and cheese and wine. Are you there with apples? Do you have that kind of connoisseur approach?
Yeah, a little bit. Small sweet apples, good peat with some cheese, and I had a red apples and.
We usually hear, you know, I grew up, you know, you could buy Red Delicious at the store, and I'm really glad we've got a lot more to go with. What are some of your favorites? First of all, just for old-fashioned eating apples.
Old-fashioned eating apples? I love the Cortland. That's my favorite apple by far. I struggled wanting to put in Macintosh because I've never had a good one. It was always mealy. But if you keep them in cold storage at 34 degrees, they last a lot longer than people expect. I can keep those until the end of January easily.
And that's a good point. Apples are a great storage kind of crop, so we can be eating pretty good, still fresh-tasting apples if they're stored right for months, right?
Yes, all apples should be refrigerated. And common storage is your refrigerator at 40 degrees, but an orchard can keep apples a lot longer at 34 degrees.
Now, let's talk about the Honeycrisp. This came out of nowhere, as far as I could tell, and they're all over the place, and I love them. I mean, I like them, too. What is it about Honeycrisp that made them so popular?
Well, it's really sweet flavor. They're crisp, juicy, very juicy, and that just brings it so popular for people that they don't need a mealy apple. They last for a year. You can keep a Honeycrisp almost a year in cold storage without any chemicals.
We heard from some more listeners on Facebook. Two people mentioned the same variety. Sue said we discovered Harrelson apples while living in Minnesota and planted her own tree when we moved back to Wisconsin. And Rebecca said Harrelson from Minnesota as well. She says they were getting popular until Honeycrisps came along. I don't know if I've heard about this one, Kurt. Harrelson's?
Yeah, I don't carry the Harrelson's. I should put a few in because a lot of people ask about them. It's a really good apple. It's pretty late in the season, though. And I target farmer's markets, so I try to stick with a little bit earlier apples.
Yeah, what goes into mapping out an orchard for the different varieties and the times that they're going to come, be ready to pick?
Well, when I started mine, I was looking to graft the trees and stuff. So I tried to get varieties in my area that all the orchards didn't have. And if they did have them, they don't have very many trees of them. So I have some newer varieties around here for Green Bay, like the Oriole Apple, Macoon, Spartan, Snow Sweet, Ida Red. They're just really good apples, and I feel I can set myself apart from others by having a variety they don't have.
Talking to Kurt Leiderman, owner of Appalicious Orchard in Green Bay, Wisconsin. We're exploring the world of apple varieties, going off the beaten path a little bit when we can. Kurt, I've seen that name, Oriole apples. I have never experienced it personally. Give us a taste.
Oh, it's a really early apple. It's a mid-August apple. It's a red-green, first red-green apple I have of the season. It's a sweet, tart balance, and it's crisp and firm. Just really good for fresh eating, pies.
What are some of your other favorite baking types of apples?
Baking apples. Cortland's Ice, a really good baking apple, but I pushed a lot more for Fireside and Connell Red. They're both very good apples with a complexity flavor of sweetness, and they hold firm in a pie, but yet they can cook down for sauce and stuff as well.
Yeah, that reminds me. One of our listeners on the Facebook page mentioned making applesauce out of apples. And I've made great applesauce in my life, and I've made terrible applesauce, and I think it was all down to apple selection. What are good saucing apples?
Cortland's, Macintosh, and Spartan apples are excellent for saucing. Also, the Ida Red I have is a tart apple. That's a late November apple. But if you cook it with the skins on, you'll have pink applesauce.
All right. Now, my number one favorite thing to do with apples is to make apple crisp out of them. I assume that the same rules for pies are going to apply there, right, as far as my selection?
Yeah, that's correct.
Now, do you experiment with new apples? You mentioned grafting those trees. Do you have ones you might not plant in bulk, but with some just to try a few each year?
I just grafted some varieties that I had picked up from others' orchards, and then I'm pretty much done with the grafting stage now because my orchard's filled up with trees at the time.
Now, grafting, I've heard of this. Explain how grafting works with apple trees.
Well, basically, you take a rootstock, which I buy in bulk. I buy a bunch of rootstocks, and you just cut it at a 45, and you take a top of a tree, they call it the water shoot, or the suckers, the sucker branches. So you cut that at a 45. And then I do a whip and tongue. So I cut down the center of the two pieces and slide them together. You offset it to one side because you want to line up the cambium layer. That's your growing layer. And then you just tape and tar it and put it in the fridge until you can put it in when the ground thaws in the spring. And you got a tree started.
And is that, so do I, am I using a root of one variety and I guess the trunk of another variety? Or am I mixing and matching when I'm grafting?
The roots stock, I'm not real sure about. I never researched that at all. But what it is a non-bearing fruit tree.
Ah.
It would not bear fruit. So it's just a root stock that started, and it looks like about a 2-foot tree when you buy it. And you just put an apple variety on top of that rootstock and graft it in to have the variety you want to grow.
In our last few moments, Kurt, do you have a favorite apple-based dessert?
Favorite apple dessert? I like apple muffins.
Ooh, that sounds great. Kurt, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
You bet. Thank you for your time.
That's Kurt Leiderman, owner of Appalicious Orchard in Green Bay. He joins us to talk about some apple varieties we might be less familiar with and how the apples are made in the first place. You can check out more about his orchard and how to get some of their pre-picked apples at appaliciousorchard.com. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, indoor air quality is a concern in normal times, but it's a huge deal as Wisconsin prepares for winter during the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. A Wisconsin chemistry researcher shares the latest findings about protecting our health indoors. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll look at a handful of top national political stories, including the state of the presidential race, with 3 weeks to go until Election Day. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network.